This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm delighted to have in the studio with me the great novelist and poet Margaret Atwood. She's the winner of the Booker Prize. She's written more than 40 books, including, of course, The Handmaid's Tale and her most recent, The Year of the Flood. Margaret Atwood, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You're here in Madison, Wisconsin, around Earth Day. You have a lot of environmentalism in this latest book, The Year of the Flood. In fact, the best group in there, the gardeners, have a mythology that they have constructed, and saints, and the saints are all environmentalists like Rachel Carson and E.O. Wilson and Yul Gibbons and Diane Fossey. And you say you're using up the earth. It's almost gone in that book, or the narrator says, or Adam 1 says.
For instance.
And so tell me about how you have taken up this issue.
Well, I was born into this issue because my father was a forest entomologist, which means that he was aware of things such as spraying forests for things like spruce budworm was counterproductive in that it didn't really stop infestations and it killed everything else in the forest and wasn't good for the people who were exposed to it either. So he was an early proponent of not doing that, but of course nobody listened. My parents were gardeners themselves, and perforce they used environmental techniques because it was during the war, you know, and you didn't have a lot of these new sorts of chemicals and things. So that is just really how I grew up. And I've never ceased being interested in it, and I do have a great big clippings box in which I accumulate stuff. And my family were scientifically inclined rather than being literary, so my brother did turn into a neurophysiologist, and I almost became a scientist myself. I could have gone that way.
And why didn't you?
I started writing. I started writing. It was just very compelling, and my brother and I were both, we were actually both teenage writers, and he was, I have to say, better than I was, and he went into science, and I went into writing.
In The Year of the Flood, I mean, this is not only an environmental dystopia. You have the corporations taking over, essentially a company like Blackwater, an armaments private mercenary company taking over.
Well, they do the security. There's actually more private security in the U.S. right now than there are publicly funded public space defenders such as police forces. And what you really, really don't want, and yes, I did know Jane Jacobs, what you really don't want is a meld of government and commerce. You really want to keep those two things separate because once you have that meld, you've got mega corruption and you've also got no third party to whom you can go and say, this stuff is poisoning my kids.
Well, I saw that you wrote once along those lines that after 9/11, we faced the prospect of two contradictory dystopias at once.
That's right.
Open markets, closed mines.
That's
where we are.
Well, it is a real possibility. The other person who's written about this is Lewis Hyde. He says it's quite possible to have a free market economy, but not a free society.
What are you? How'd you get on this dystopia jag?
What can I tell you? I was born in 1939. You know, as a child, it was the war, and it was the war that the people in our country, Canada, were losing at that time. Canada went in 1939, unlike the United States. And it looked very, very bleak. And I couldn't have known anything about it because I was too young, but there's an atmosphere that kids pick up. So then, of course, D-Day, I was five. And I do remember that quite clearly. I was in Sault Ste. Marie, which is, you may not know where that is, but it's in the Canadian North. And that's an event that I can recall. And then right after the war, of course, it was still basically the war, particularly in Canada, whose economy was quite affected by the fact that we sent a lot of people and material to Europe, and we continued to do so after the war.
I'm speaking
with
Margaret.
So we were still very pretty obsessed by it, and I read Churchill as soon as it came out, and I read all those books like Rommel and things like that.
And Margaret Atwood, you also have said that George Orwell had a big influence on you.
Read George Orwell probably almost as soon as 1984 came out. Read Animal Farm as a child, thinking it was like Winnie the Pooh, that it would be about these animals. And I didn't know that it wasn't. I thought the pigs were real pigs and that the horse was a real horse, and I was just wrecked by it.
You call your work not science fiction, but speculative fiction, I've read. Well, what is the distinction you're drawing?
I think the distinction has to do with lineages. It has to do with ancestries and what family books belong to, because books do belong in families. So the ancestor of science fiction as we have it today is H.G. Wells, with books like The Time Machine and The War of the Worlds. And those books involve things that are very unlikely to happen. In fact, you could say it's impossible that they will happen. But they're ways of exploring possibilities and human nature and how people react to certain kinds of things. And if you go to another planet, of course, you get to build the whole society there, so you can build blueprints that way. Plus have fun with talking vegetation and other such things. The lineage of speculative fiction, I would say it's Jules Verne, who wrote about things that he could see coming to pass that were possible on the Earth. Wasn't outer space, and it wasn't space invasions or any kinds of things like that. There were things we might actually do. There were a lot of utopias in the 19th century, wonderful societies that we might actually construct. Those went pretty much out of fashion after the First World War. And almost immediately, one of the utopias that people were trying to construct, namely the Soviet Union, threw out a writer called Zamyatin, who wrote a seminal book called We, which contains the seeds of Orwell and Huxley. So we started doing dystopias after we had seen the effects of trying to build utopias that required, unfortunately, the elimination of a lot of people before you could get to the really perfect point, which never arrived.
So you can't see yourself ever writing a utopia?
I don't believe in a perfect world. I don't believe it's achievable, and I believe that people who try to achieve it usually end up turning into Cambodia or something very similar, because purity tests set in. You know, are you ideologically pure enough to be allowed to live? Well, it turns out that very few people are. And then it becomes a power struggle and a big mass killing scene. How many people did Stalin actually bump off? Really huge numbers.
And Pol Pot, too, as you're suggesting.
Yes, and we won't even bother mentioning Hitler, because everybody knows about that one, but there's a whole bunch that they don't know about.
You're against utopia. You fear utopia. And the question becomes, how do you move people without toward some better place than they are now? How do you fight injustice?
That's different.
Without holding up a myth of something utopian.
Exactly. Well, forget perfection. Because once you start holding out a dream of perfection, number one, it's not achievable, and number two, you kill a lot of people. But going slower, more gradualist, shall we say, more progressive by increments way, that's what we have to hold on to, because without that, there's no hope, and you descend into anarchy, chaos, criminality, and totalitarianism. of a different kind. That kind of totalitarianism is usually based on, in order to keep you safe, we have to obliterate all your civil rights. You know, which do you want, safety or civil rights, in which there is always an element of uncertainty? But of course, there's no such thing as perfect safety either. If you really wanted everybody to be safe, you would have to do away with automobiles, which kill a huge number of people every year.
Margaret Atwood is my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You wrote a letter to America after 9/11 and...
No, just on the eve of the invasion of Iraq. I wrote another piece just then called Napoleon's Two Biggest Mistakes. And that was not a don't do it, you bad people. It was a, where are you going with this? Where will this lead you? And in Letter to America, I did predict a great big black hole of debt, which has now come to pass. Not only for that reason, the mortgage meltdown was part of that. Mortgage meltdown happened because you obliterated the rules. So that's a somewhat different story, but... Napoleon's two biggest mistakes were invading Spain and, in the interests of progress, deposing the king and taking away all those gold shiny things in the churches in order to do away with superstition, because those gold shiny things would really be better off in France. And the Spanish actually objected to this and launched a huge guerrilla movement, which gave us the Goya sketches and paintings. They had some help from the Duke of Wellington, but essentially that war was lost by Napoleon because the Spanish took up civil arms against the occupying army. So rule number one, don't underestimate people's attachment to their own stuff. Mistake number two was invading Russia when it didn't need to be when there was no threat coming from it, except the remote possibility in the future it might possibly invade you. But the real truth was that Napoleon liked invading things. He got bored when he wasn't doing it.
Well, and George Bush got bored too.
Well, I don't know whether that was boredom. Yes, he really liked invading things. He really underestimated the Russians, and he thought they should play by his rules. So he got to Moscow, and if it was his rules, they would have turned up with a surrender. But instead, they burnt it and moved further back. And he sat there waiting for them to turn up, and they didn't turn up. They weren't going to play by his rules, because by his rules, they would have lost. So if your rules are rules that will cause the other side to lose, they won't play by those rules, no more than the Americans did during the Revolutionary War. They didn't line up in squares and shoot, you know, in lines and...
In uniforms.
Yeah, they did some of that, but also they snuck around through the woods and did mean, sneaky guerrilla things that the British thought just weren't fair.
Something to think about now as we're in Afghanistan, too.
Well, a lesson from your own history. How did you win that Revolutionary War?
I'm speaking with Margaret Atwood. In your letter to America, you talked about... Well, you had a line, you're gutting the Constitution.
Yeah. Yes, well, this is the point at which people say, well, in order to keep you safe, we have to remove all our previously wonderfully democratic safeguards against, for instance, people simply disappearing.
How fragile do you think the fabric of democracy is here in the United States? How quickly could things... dissolve.
The fabric of democracy is always fragile everywhere because it depends on the will of citizens to defend it. And when they get scared, when it becomes dangerous for them to defend it, they're just ordinary people. You know, they don't have armies. They don't have bureaucracies. It can go very quickly.
That's frightening. And also another thing that I found frightening in your work, Margaret Atwood, is this, and this is kind of like Orwell, too, is your notion of how easy it is for people to betray each other.
Well,
how
it's
easy,
not,
that's yeah. a line straight out of your book, Year of the Flood.
Well, again, I mean, this is poor old Winston Smith, and in 1984, he is, in fact, tortured. And I always remember not that book, but The Wind in the Willows, when Toad of Toad Hall goes in and gets reprehended and lectured at by Badger, and he comes and he repents and swears that he will be good from now on, and he comes out and immediately reverts to his bad old Toad self. And they said, "But you said this," and he said, "I would have said anything in there." And that is typically what happens under torture. People will say anything, whether it's true or not.
Also, along these lines, in Handmaid's Tale, you talk about people's willingness after a while, and sometimes it's after a short while, to accept what's going on as the usual, as the norm.
What is their choice? Some people said to me when The Handmaid's Tale came out, "Why weren't there any protests?" I said, "You don't understand totalitarianisms." There were groups working against Hitler in Germany. They were killed. You know, they don't. A real totalitarianism does not fool around with such things as protest on the street. So even if you may not like a certain kind of protest on the street, like the recent in favor of guns march on Washington, you don't want a society in which protests cannot happen.
But since things can go downhill so fast, and once they go downhill, you can't protest, what are we to do?
What are we to do? Well, I'm not saying they will go downhill so fast. In fact, America is still a country where local groups are quite active, communities are quite active, especially smaller communities. You still have voting, and you need to watch those voting machines, I have to tell you. They're very hackable. And you should really keep an eye on who owns them and runs them, because the people who control the machines are essentially controlling your vote unless you get a paper printout. So you really have to watch the voting process. And I was quite alarmed recently when it turned out that corporations were being treated the same as individuals as far as campaign contributions were concerned, because it's corporations actually are not individuals.
This is the Supreme Court case, Citizens United, you're referring to.
I'm Canadian, and we have caps on how much you can give.
You say Canada, you've written, Canada has a viable left, the U.S. does not.
Well, it has a left party called the NDP, and the background of it was that it was a farmers' party during the Depression, and then it became an industrial workers' party. And it's still there. It's a third party, but Canada actually has five political parties right now, and they are the Conservative Party, the Liberal Party, the New Democratic Party, which is the one I've been speaking of, the Green Party, and the Bloc Québécois, which, in a typically Canadian paradoxical contradiction, its mandate is to secede from Canada, but it sits in our House of Parliament.
Margaret Atwood, is there a right-wing resurgence in Canada as there is here in the United States?
Canadians are not polarized in the same way, and they tend to switch their votes, apart from certain hardcore bases of each one. They tend to switch their votes according to who they think is going to do the kind of job that they want to see done. And I think their problem at the moment is they don't know who to vote for. You know, they don't know who really represents them. The party that has the minority control in Parliament right now came in on a platform of openness, transparency, representationalism, you know, that they would really represent the voters. And now that they're in, they have clammed up tighter than anybody ever has before. And they're getting quite scary in that respect, and they're also having all the corruption problems that they campaigned against in the previous government. So who do you vote for? How do you what politicians can you trust? I think it's the same here. I noticed in the paper today that more and more people were registering as unaffiliated because they just don't know what to do. And I think not knowing what to do is a symptom of the times that we're now entering. We've dragged a lot of baggage left, right, etc., from the 20th century that doesn't apply anymore. And we're facing a century in which we have growing climate disruption, which is going to affect food crops. There's going to be more floods. There's going to be more droughts. We're going to be facing more crises of that kind on a planetary level, and the systems that we put in place in the 20th century are just not going to work the way they did anymore. We've run out of stuff.
Is the Green Party up in Canada gaining support because of that?
Well, I think if there were only two parties, it would probably have a lot of support. But there are five parties, and people do vote their jobs. What else are they going to do? They have families. They have to eat. They're worried about their economic future, et cetera, et cetera. So any party that's going to take people in a green direction is going to have to show the job and economic benefits of doing that. And people are still in the figuring it out stage of that. How do we really make this work for people? And Bill McKibben's new book called, I don't know how to pronounce it, EAARTH, has got a fourth section, which is very good on that subject. So our big problems coming down the road are going to be energy supply and food supply. And this is not a right-left issue. It's a people issue. It's going to affect everybody, and it cuts across all of the previous kinds of distinctions and definitions that we're used to making.
Margaret Atwood, a lot of what you've written has also been about the role of women. I mean, that's in, obviously, Handmaid's Tale to the max, and the Year of the Flood as well. You've written that the liberation of women is also precarious, just as democracy is precarious.
It absolutely is, but the other factor that ties into all of this is that the education of women is seen as one of the best things that you can do for the kinds of problems that we have and that we're facing, because women will take that education and they will apply it towards ameliorating the lives of their families. So that is a very potent tool, and helping that education and empowerment of women is, believe it or not, the humble cell phone, which allows women to be small business people based in their homes, and also allows them to gather the kind of information that they need. They don't have to travel and go off to other places necessarily. The information can come to them. So that's going to be a very big factor, and literacy is going to be a very big factor in that, teaching women to read, which is, of course, in The Handmaid's Tale, what they try to reverse. They say, we're not going to make that mistake again.
Margaret Atwood is my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. I'm struck by the fact that you elevate the humble cell phone and Bill McKibben elevates the Internet, which obviously you can access through some of
the humble cell phone.
So there is a possibility that this technology we can use to help things along, which is one of the hopeful signs we have.
Yes, I mean, the Internet is 95% porn and spam, but if you if you aren't doing that, there is a lot of other really useful stuff and a lot of ranting and raving. I mean, you have to know how to sort it out, and that's often a very big task because, again, you don't know whether what you're reading on the Internet is true.
You wrote once, I don't write pretty books, do you?
No.
Why?
Sorry. I don't know. I guess I'm just not, I don't know whether there are any really pretty novels. There's novels that end well, but in between there are human beings acting like human beings, and human beings are not perfect. And all of the motives that a human being may have, which are mixed. We all have mixed motives. That's the novelist's material. That's where they have to go. And a lot of that just isn't pretty. You know, we like to think of ourselves as really, really good people, but look in the mirror. You know, really look and look at your own mixed motives. And then multiply that.
Do you think everyone has the potential to be a fascist?
Does everyone have the potential to be a fascist? Well, that's one of those, does everybody have the potential to be a cannibal? You know, if you were stuck on a lifeboat and your choice was dying or eating somebody else, which would you do? And it's one of those things that we don't know the answer to until we're there. So we don't actually know how we would behave. I can tell you that a lot of people faced with fascism did not become fascists. So I'm not sure that that's true. I think that's one of those, we're all secretly monsters, and I just don't happen to think it's true.
But you kind of set up lifeboat situations in some of your novels.
I think we're in a lifeboat situation, or we're not there yet in this country. Let me put it another way. A lot of people in this biosphere are in lifeboat situations right now, in which they're faced with choices, none of which are good. And that is a lifeboat situation.
What do you recommend to people in those situations, or what do you recommend to us?
I would be an idiot to try to recommend anything to a person in that situation, because I don't know how I myself would behave. So where would I get off telling people what to do?
Certainly we in the United States, as one of the leading polluter, can try to do something to...
Oh, I think we're topping you. I think Canada's now heading towards being a leading polluter.
There's a distinction you can have.
Yeah, I don't know whether we're ton for ton emitting more carbon, but per capita we are. And a lot of that is due to the big oil sands, tar sands development, which is humongous. Canada used to think of itself as, you know, clean-handed, nice, sweet Canada, but I think we have to, again, look in the mirror pretty hard and see what we're actually doing.
So it's incumbent upon us in the U.S. and in Canada to make sure that those people in those lifeboats don't have to come up with terrible decisions.
You know, that would be wonderful. The problem is huge. 75 million people were added to the already large proportion of people on the globe who are malnourished all the time. No, essentially their bodies are being starved. How do you take that on? Again, I think you can't do it just by throwing money at it. A lot of that money in countries that are really stressed doesn't go to those people anyway. It goes into somebody's pocket and into a Swiss bank account. So how do you deal with that? How many aid workers can you send? How much will they be believed? I think you have to empower the people who live there by getting them the information tools, the information sharing that they need. And they're already doing that themselves. They're already sharing around the kind of farming techniques that will actually work. And you can find those in the last chapter of Bill McKibben's book.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at there. We're out of time, unfortunately. Margaret Atwood, thanks so much for being my guest today.
And thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.